30 minutes, 19 april 2020. Dit is het bulletin van zondag. Daily Minutes, 19 april 2020. Het is het bulletin van zondag. Ik maak me er vanwege de tijdgebrek, maar ik maak me er in ieder geval een beetje makkelijk vanaf door het in te spreken op de Tascam recorder. Dat is toch wat minder bewerkelijk dan de microfoon op te stellen. Het gekke is, eigenlijk zou het niet moeten uitmaken, maar als ik die microfoon heb op een statief, dat is zo'n heel groot ding met zo'n plopfilter ervoor, zo'n rond schijfje, maar in ieder geval zo'n rond ding met luidsprekerdoek ertussen die het plop-effect moet tegengaan. Maar op een of andere manier is dat relaxter dan met dit ding. Ik heb dit ding gewoon in mijn hand en dat is bij het statief niet zo. Maar ja, de microfoon met het statief is best groot en die staat ook wel eens in de weg. Dan kan ik het scherm niet zien en al van dat soort dingen, of ik kan niet makkelijk bij het toetsenbord. En toch is dat relaxter op een of andere manier en ik kan dat niet helemaal verklaren, maar goed. Misschien komt het van de vroegere haast die ik wel eens had bij het inspreken van de Daily Minutes. Maar tenminste van de Daily Minutes toen ik nog op de repeater zat. Ik ben inmiddels aan het nadenken om uitzendingen weer te gaan inspreken. Die zijn dan wel korter, maar dan zijn ze wel vers van de pers en uniek, net ingesproken. Dus ik heb nog een serie waarvan ik 3 afleveringen gedaan heb over propagatie. Ik wil die eigenlijk wel afmaken. Maar ik denk dat het daarvoor nodig is dat ik ook voor mezelf de eerste 3 afleveringen beluister. Ik denk dat het handig is om ze dan in de uitzending te doen, want dan hoor ik ze wel voorbij komen. Een ander iets wat ik heb, dat is dat het wel leuk lijkt om iets over spionage te doen. Dat heb ik in het verleden ook al regelmatig gedaan. Vanavond heb ik iets over spionage. Dat is wel heel erg leuk. Dat is ongeveer het bekendste, niet het bekendste, maar wel het meest succesvolle verhaal van de inlichtingendiensten. En dat is uit de Tweede Wereldoorlog. De inlichtingendiensten bestaan nog niet zo lang. Hè? Amerika die had volgens mij in 1930 nog niet een serieuze inlichtingendienst. Hoe anders is dat nu? Maar in het Verenigd Koninkrijk stamt dat ook van de eerste jaren van de 20e eeuw. Hè? Dus tussen 1900 en 1910 dat voor het eerst opgang deed. Nu is dat eigenlijk allemaal niet meer weg te denken. En zeker in het digitale tijdperk niet. Maar dat is toch een relatief nieuw verschijnsel. Wat ze in de Tweede Wereldoorlog deden, ik heb daar eerder ook wel eens iets over gepubliceerd, dat er bijvoorbeeld berichten van een dag eerder werden uitgezonden. En ja, echt wel heel erg dat de mensen in Duitsland daardoor op het verkeerde moment in de schuilkelders gingen en vervolgens door de bombardementen min of meer overvallen werden. Dat was door bedriegelijke signalen met zenders. Ze namen dan de nieuwsberichten van een dag eerder op. En de Duitsers die schakelden zenders uit in het gebied waar de bommenwerpers naartoe gingen, om het die bommenwerpers niet te gemakkelijk te maken. Ze konden anders peilen op de zenders. Er werden dus de zenders in die buurt uitgezet. En de Engelsen die namen dan de frequentie over met de zender vanuit Engeland. En herhaalden dan bericht van de dag daarvoor. Nou, dit gaat nog een stukje verder qua hoe grof eigenlijk dat gedaan werd. Maar het heeft wel de dingen rond D-Day heel sterk bespoedigd. Dus dat was wel een goed idee. En ze hadden geluk doordat ze veel inlichtingenmateriaal hadden. En ook doordat ze toevallig een soort van fetish van Adolf Hitler te pakken hadden. Die zich focuste met name op een bepaald gebied. En dat was waar zij toevallig verkeerde informatie over verspreiden. En daardoor werd er niet adequaat opgetreden toen ze vervolgens wat anders deden. Maar goed, hoe ze dat precies voor elkaar kregen, dat is een heel verhaal. En het is ook wel heel heftig. Maar het is wel interessant. Dat heb ik dus als enige item in de uitzending. Dat duurt ongeveer 50 minuten. Ik wil eigenlijk proberen de foto's, maar ik weet niet of dat qua tijd lukt. Maar de foto's die ik de 17e heb uitgezonden, die waren allemaal mislukt met DRM. En ik denk dat dat komt doordat er op mijn computer op dat moment te veel toepassingen draaiden. Ik zag in het scopebeeld van de uitzendingen, zoals je dat in Audacity kunt bekijken, dat er af en toe stukjes wegvielen. En het rare is bij het beluisteren, in ieder geval bij mij is dat zo, daar gaat QSS TV helemaal van, het valt maar een heel klein stukje uit. En wat er eigenlijk gebeurd is volgens mij, dat de sinus gewoon uitgerekt wordt. Hè? Dus dat de tijd, hoe zeg je dat, te snel verloopt. Nou, in ieder geval, er gebeurt daar iets in de tijd. En het programma raakt daar zodanig van slag, dat terwijl er eigenlijk maar een heel korte drop-out is, dat het programma toch helemaal in de war raakt en daar pas een seconde of wat later weer synchronisatie oppikt. En ja, dan is het te laat. Dan wordt het plaatje niet meer weergegeven. Dus ik ga nu een nieuwe poging doen, kijken of ik dat beter voor elkaar kan krijgen. Is ook wel een leuk experiment, denk ik. Hè? Maar goed, het hangt er vanaf hoeveel tijd dat er is. Het is trouwens wel heel moeilijk om nieuwsberichten te vinden over de hobby die niet over corona gaan. Een artikel is dat 60 jaar geleden amateurs voor het eerst verbinding maakten via de ionisatie die door satellieten veroorzaakt wordt. Volgens mij is dat bij de lancering, maar ik weet dat niet helemaal zeker. Ik kan me niet voorstellen dat de ionisatie zo groot is dat dat ook onder normale omstandigheden gaat. Maar het is wel een leuk artikel. Ik heb het niet gelezen, maar het is wel, ja, waren twee tieners die de eerste verbinding maakten. Een interessant fenomeen. Ik wist daar wel iets van, maar niet superveel. Volgens mij is dat ook nagenoeg het enige artikel. Hé, wat gebeurt er nu? Al mijn tv gaat aan. Maar is dat ook het enige artikel dat op Veerom.nl staat dat niet. Nee, de Veeromdag is er ook nog. De Vredeshaven afgelast door corona. Nou, het gaat zo maar door. Eens even kijken of we nog meer berichten hebben. Ook internationaal wordt het nieuws van. Hoe noem je dat? Ook internationaal wordt het amateurnieuws gedomineerd door corona. Er zijn maar een paar uitzonderingen. In India, waar het amateurisme een upswing doormaakt, hoe zeg je dat in goed Nederlands, daar moeten de centamateurs hun rol nog een beetje vinden. Ze worden vaak ingezet door de overheid. En bijvoorbeeld een paar jaar geleden zagen de vissers die daar ofwel geen communicatie hebben of heel primitieve communicatie, die zagen de opkomende amateurhobby in India. En die gingen prompt staken omdat zij amateurzenders aan boord wilden hebben van de schepen. Die begrepen het ook niet helemaal. Ja, regelmatig duiken in India berichten op, zoals nu ook op southgatearc.org staat. Iemand in India, een ouder iemand in een afgelegen plaats, die had bepaalde medicijnen niet. Die konden daar ook niet geleverd worden. Dus dat is gek, want de meeste medicijnen worden in China en in India gemaakt. Maar hoe die medicijnen waren er niet. En toen is er een amateur en die pikte dat op. Die hoorde via de amateurzender hoorde die daarvan. En die heeft vervolgens die medicijnen gebracht. Ja, in India gebeurt dat veel, ook bij disaster relief. Het heeft natuurlijk ook wel nut om daarop te focussen. Omdat ze daar de overheid nog een beetje mee moeten trekken. Centamateurs die zijn er in India al heel lang overigens. Maar er zijn wel problemen. Laatst was het een keer zo dat. Dan weet ik niet meer precies de aantallen, maar er waren vier amateurs en die hadden examen gedaan en dat duurde maar en dat duurde maar. En uiteindelijk, ik weet niet meer of het nou 20 of 30 jaar na hun examen was, dat ze eindelijk pas hun call kregen. Dat was toch ook wel heel bijzonder. Amateurs worden ook wel ingezet bij het afluisteren van terroristen in de grensgebieden, die vaak zelf ook op amateurfrequenties zitten daar. Dus het is ook wel logisch dat amateurs daar dan naar kunnen luisteren. En bovendien, de lokale amateurs kennen vaak de dialecten die bij de overheid ook niet alom begrepen worden. Dus dat heeft ook wel voordelen. Daarnaast worden amateurs al heel lang in India, al wel heel lang, maar een jaar of 10 of zo, ingezet bij de dijkbewaking. Dus, maar goed, nu een amateur, dus die de medische. Ja, dat zijn dingen die zouden hier ook kunnen gebeuren, natuurlijk. Hè? Een ander opmerkelijk bericht is Ofcom in de UK, die. Dat is eigenlijk de agentschap Telecom. Nou, dat komt natuurlijk niet helemaal precies overeen, want die diensten die verschillen allemaal wel een beetje per land. Maar zeg maar de agentschap Telecom van de UK. En die hebben net als onze agentschap Telecom recent metingen gedaan aan 5G mobiele opstelpunten. En zij kwamen daarbij tot de conclusie, in Nederland was de conclusie dat in elk geval nergens de straling de norm overschreed en meestal daar ruim onder bleef. Hier is de conclusie dat de straling meestal van 5G zit rond de 1,5% van wat toegestaan is. En soms zelfs 0,039 van het maximum wat volgens internationale maatstaven mag. Ik verwacht eigenlijk ook wel een beetje dat om verschillende redenen 5G veel minder stralingsbelasting geeft dan de 3G en de 4G die we nu hebben. Overigens is tegen 4G ook uitgebreid geprotesteerd in Nederland. Al beseffen we dat niet zo, omdat dat toen nog een andere naam had. Maar je had stichting Stop, of een website, ik weet niet of het een stichting was, maar in ieder geval StopUMTS.nl. En die protesteren tegen UMTS. Maar ja, in de UK protesteren ze op hetzelfde moment. Ik heb als iemand geïnterviewd daar. Oh nee hoor, UMTS is helemaal niet gevaarlijk. Dat is helemaal verkeerd. In de UK waren ze benauwd voor Tetra. En in België en Frankrijk dan weer voor dekt telefoons en voor wifi. Tenminste in Frankrijk meer voor dekt en wifi en in België voor wifi. Dus het verschilt per land waar mensen ziek van worden. Dat, zo is het eigenlijk. En dat, dat gaf in die tijd wel aan dat dat toch, hoe zeg je dat, misschien toch niet de straling helemaal de oorzaak was. Hè? En ja, goed, met de signalen zoals bij 5G. Met de signalen is wel heel veel ervaring. Alleen met het modulatieprincipe wat erop gezet wordt niet. En dat wordt door de twijfelaars of de, hoe zeg je dat, de mensen die daar hun bedenkingen tegen hebben, toch nu aangegrepen. En dat was bij Tetra ook al zo. Om te zeggen van ja, nee, maar met die frequenties is wel veel ervaring. Maar niet met dat modulatietype. Ik denk niet dat het modulatietype daar veel voor uitmaakt. Maar goed, het is niet uit te sluiten. Ook weer, je kunt gewoon niet bewijzen dat het niet gevaarlijk is. Goed, maar dan ga ik nu in ieder geval beginnen met het item over de Tweede Wereldoorlog. En ik vond het zelf geweldig toen ik het hoorde. Echt machtig interessant. Zodanig dus dat ik hem nu ook gewoon nog een keer ga luisteren.
It's the most outrageous, disgusting, preposterous, not to say barbaric idea.
The strangest spy story in the annals of naval intelligence. This is the man who created the man who never was.
You wave an airy hand and say, George, go and get a body, as though there was nothing to it. Well, you tried.
Nonsense. There are hospitals, nursing homes, mortuaries.
I've tried them, not a hope. You see, Monty, everybody belongs to somebody. And it isn't a thing people want messed about.
This is the traitor who tried to expose the man who never was.
Good evening.
Yes, what do you want?
I'm making some inquiries about a friend of mine, William Martin.
This is the girl who held the secret of the man who never was.
Lucy, this is Mr. Patrick O'Reilly.
Hello there.
Mr. O'Reilly is making inquiries about Willie Martin.
Willie Martin? Willie Martin? It's no good making inquiries about him, mister. Willie Martin doesn't exist.
This is a true story. It actually happened, but it could not be told until now.
Glinder Michael was born on January 4th, 1909, in the southern Welsh town of Aberbargoed. He had two sisters, and he was the son of a coal miner. When Michael was just 15 years old, his father committed suicide, and he was prematurely made into the man of the house, a role he was not quite ready for. He ended up working as a day laborer, primarily as a gardener, leading up to the Great Depression, when Michael should have been entering the prime of his life. He struggled to keep a steady job over the next several years, continuing to live with his mother and his two sisters. When World War II kicked off, he was not drafted into the Allied forces, suggesting that he was not fit for military service. Some have even theorized that he might have been suffering from a mental illness, made worse by his rampant alcoholism, which made it hard for him to function in society. In 1940, when Glinder Michael was 31 years old, his mother passed away, leaving him homeless, friendless, broke, and depressed. Following this tragic loss, he drifted towards the city of London, where he lived on the streets as a tramp. In January of 1943, 3 years removed from his mother's loss, Glinder Michael was barely surviving in the King's Cross district of central London. He lived on the streets as a beggar, traveling from abandoned building to abandoned building in an effort to stay warm, his frame becoming more and more malnourished with every passing day. On the cold and bitter evening of January 22nd, 1943, Glinder Michael was found in an abandoned warehouse. He was deathly ill, having ingested what would later be determined to be rat poison. This was a phosphorus-based poison, which came in a paste form that caretakers often smeared on bread to attract rats. It was possible that Glinder Michael had ingested this poison not in an attempt to take his own life, but out of pure desperation. He was rushed to a nearby hospital, where he clung onto life for the next couple of days. The type of poison that he ingested, phosphorus, did not outright kill the young man. Rather, it reacted with the hydrochloric acid in his stomach, creating a toxic gas named phosphide. Dr. Bentley Purchase, the coroner of St. Pancras, described the conditions that Glinder Michael ultimately succumbed to. Quote, "This dose was not sufficient to kill him outright, and its only effect was so to impair the functioning of the liver that he died a little time afterwards. After suffering in the hospital for nearly 2 days, Glinder Michael passed away on January 24th, 1943, just 20 days after his 34th birthday. His death certificate listed his cause of death as phosphorus poisoning, took rat poison, bid to kill himself while of unsound mind. Glinder Michael was a young man whose life had ultimately not amounted to much. The only semblance of a legacy he left behind was his reputation among the other beggars and destitutes on the streets of London. However, in death, this young man was able to alter the course of human history." The conflict we now refer to as World War II was precipitated by a long period of escalations, stemming from the fallout of the original World War, referred to in the preceding years as the Great War. In addition to tensions being raised between Japan and China, the leader of Germany's Nazi Party, Adolf Hitler, served as a primary catalyst. In September of 1939, Germany invaded Poland in a blitzkrieg attack meant to shock and awe. The United Kingdom responded by giving Germany an ultimatum, an ultimatum that was ultimately ignored by Adolf Hitler. 2 days later, on September 3rd, in coordination with France and the other countries allied with the UK, war was officially declared.
The responsibility lies on the shoulders of one man. By his latest act of naked aggression, Hitler has committed a crime not only against Poland, but against the whole human race. Against the mothers and children leaving the cities of Britain under the Great Evacuation Scheme with a smoothness and speed that avoids a single accident or delay. As they start out on what to them is the great adventure, already German troops, guns, and planes have crossed the Polish border to kill and to destroy. So Britain prepares to fight, and never in our history have we been so united in a knowledge that our cause is just. We have no material interest in the quarrel between Germany and Poland, but we shall be fighting for something which is vital to our life and to the life of all civilized people. For in a world where the rights of the weak and the honor of the pledged word can be overruled by the high hand of military power, there is no tolerable life for nations or for peoples. So in spite of our hatred of war, we must meet force with force. And as our children move from the crowded cities to the kind care of newfound friends in safer places, what a tragic contrast to the preparations for the horrible struggle that may lie ahead.
Just a few weeks after the beginning of the war, a memo began circulating throughout Britain's naval intelligence. Published under the name of Royal Navy Rear Admiral John Godfrey, the memo became known as the Trout Memo, because it described a plan to deceive the enemy by using the same tactics as fly fishing. In this case, the enemy, the Germans, were the trout. An excerpt of the memo read, "The trout fisher cast patiently all day. He frequently changes the venue and his lures. If he has frightened a fish, he may give the water a rest for half an hour, but his main endeavor, viz. To attract fish by something he sends out from his boat, is incessant." Many believed that this memo was not written by Admiral Godfrey himself. Instead, some note that its writing bore all the hallmarks of Godfrey's assistant, Lieutenant Commander Ian Fleming. Fleming, as you may know, later gained international acclaim for his series of novels, which created the character of James Bond. His superior, Admiral Godfrey, was even credited for serving as an inspiration for the character M. In this memo, Godfrey and Fleming proposed a number of practical avenues for this plan to take effect, including a scheme inspired by a novel that Fleming had just read. One passage in particular, labeled Number 28, read, "The following suggestion is used in a book by Basil Thompson. A corpse dressed as an airman, with dispatches in his pockets, could be dropped on the coast, supposedly from a parachute that has failed. I understand there is no difficulty in obtaining corpses at the Naval Hospital, but of course, it would have to be a fresh one." This memo, which was published on September 29th, 1939, included many possible ways that these methods could be incorporated into the war effort. In addition to the nefarious scheme listed as Number 28, it also included plans to lure German U-boats into minefields, using false intelligence and stuff like that. The Trout memo would be kicked around for the next few years, as the war continued to escalate. It never really seemed to take off, despite Rear Admiral John Godfrey transitioning into his new role as the Director of Naval Intelligence. Together, along with his assistant, Ian Fleming, the two struggled to build a more cohesive intelligence unit. Plans similar to those described in the Trout memo were used throughout World War II, at least alterations of those plans. The Battle of Alam el Halfa in 1942 incorporated similar elements of Number 28, leaving behind fabricated war plans on a corpse in a German minefield. This ultimately led to a number of German tanks being led into a sand trap, where they were bogged down by machine malfunctions. Then, following the events of September of 1942, the seed of an idea was planted. An Allied plane, flying from Britain to Gibraltar, crashed off of the coast of southwestern Spain. A courier aboard the plane carried top-secret documents, and they were killed in the crash. Their remains and belongings later returned to the Allies. However, intelligence sources believed that Spain had scoured through the top-secret documents before returning them, eventually feeding that information to German officials. Naval intelligence had, for some time, been operating under the belief that Spain, technically a neutral country at this point in the war, had Axis sympathies. It was believed that the nation was rife with German spies, and that any information that Spain received, Germany received not long after. While frowned upon, this was the type of behavior that spies and scoundrels loved to exploit. In particular, two intelligence officers, who immediately began hatching a plan to take advantage of this back channel. Roughly 1 month after the plane crash off of the coast of southwestern Spain, a new plan was pitched by a British intelligence officer named Charles Cholmondeley. Cholmondeley, a flight lieutenant in the Royal Air Force, had been seconded to MI5, where he now worked on a committee whose primary focus was implementing double agents into the war effort. On October 31st, 1942, Charles Cholmondeley pitched his plan to the committee. He named this plan Trojan Horse, and a portion of the plan read, "A body is obtained from one of the London hospitals. The lungs are filled with water and documents are disposed in an inside pocket. The body is then dropped by a coastal command aircraft. On being found, the supposition in the enemy's mind may well be that one of our aircraft has either been shot or forced down, and that this is one of their passengers." This operation, nicknamed Trojan Horse, was turned down by Cholmondeley's committee. However, it was liked by a man named Ewan Montagu, whom Cholmondeley was familiar with. Ewan Montagu was a former lawyer in King's Counsel that had volunteered at the onset of the war, and now worked underneath Admiral John Godfrey in naval intelligence. In particular, he focused on naval deception, and knew that naval intelligence needed to up their operations to truly assist in the war effort. Recently, Cholmondeley and Montagu had worked together to create a network of fictitious double agents in Britain. These were fake spies, created wholesale out of nothing but imagination, whom the two intelligence officers had created entire identities for, including names, birthdays, families, jobs, etc. They had used these fake identities to supply information to the Germans, some of which was real to validate their existence, but ultimately trivial. The rest of the information, which they were hoping would inspire German battle plans, was fake. So, Charles Cholmondeley and Ewan Montagu knew one another, and respected each other's work. When the committee turned down Chumley's planned operation, Trojan Horse, Montague decided to help bring it to realization, seeing the potential in such a plan and believing that it could help turn the tide of the entire war. At this point in the war, the latter half of 1942, German forces were beginning to become spread very thin, fighting a war on almost all fronts. They had established a foothold through most of mainland Europe, but knew that an invasion by Allied forces was coming, and coming soon. German officials knew that the Allies weren't prepared to launch an all-out assault for France. The Allies knew this themselves, and estimated that the earliest date they could launch an invasion of France was more than a year out. However, they were hoping to find an alternative avenue to establish a foothold in the continent, via the south.
For 10 epoch-making days, Casablanca became the solar plexus of Anglo-American leadership. The Anfa Hotel was the meeting place when Premier Churchill and President Roosevelt, accompanied by the chiefs of staff of the two countries, laid plans for this year's offensive. The combined staffs were in almost constant session. Mr. Churchill arrives for the press conference held in the grounds overlooking the Atlantic.
The infamous Casablanca Conference, held in January of 1943, brought together Allied leaders in Morocco, known then as French Morocco. Joseph Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union, had been invited to help coordinate the Allied military plans over the next year or two, but had to remain in Russia because of the ongoing land war between him and the Nazis. The other two world leaders present at this conference, US President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill, debated, among other topics, where they should begin their invasion. They, along with their military leaders, weighed the pros and cons of starting the invasion in either Italy or the Balkans, primarily Sicily or Greece. Invading through Greece would not only help liberate a long-standing ally of Britain, Greece itself, but also begin cutting off the Nazi import of natural resources from the region, primarily oil from Romania. Their other option, Sicily, was referred to as the soft underbelly of Europe. The Allies knew that starting there would not only help topple over the Italian government, perhaps the biggest European supporter of Nazi Germany, but would also provide a valuable and somewhat centralized front for the Allies in Europe. In addition, troops already deployed to Africa would be able to easily transfer to the Italian peninsula. Some thought that Italy, namely Sicily, was too obvious a choice for invasion. Winston Churchill famously stated, quote, "Everyone but a bloody fool would know that it's Sicily." But despite this apparent opposition, in the end, it was decided that the Allies would start their European invasion via Sicily. Despite making the decision to start their invasion in Sicily, Allied commanders were concerned that the plan lacked any real grace. At the very least, they were worried that starting in Sicily would result in a significant number of casualties, and potentially irreparable harm to the Allied fleet. So, it fell on organizations such as Naval Intelligence to begin working on a misinformation campaign to get the Axis to believe that an invasion was coming from elsewhere, in particular, on the opposite side of the Ionian Sea, via Greece. This misinformation campaign went by the name of Operation Barclay, and included various agencies and officials in its effort to fool the Axis powers. Adolf Hitler had been growing increasingly concerned that an invasion would start near Greece, as this area, surrounding the Balkans, had provided Germany with a nearly endless amount of natural resources throughout the war. An invasion there could cripple the Nazi war effort, and Hitler was acutely aware of that. So, the Allies began orchestrating a campaign to feed into Hitler's own worst fears, that the invasion was heading towards Greece, near his defenseless cash cow. Ben McIntyre, an author and historian, later described this decision. Quote, "We were, thanks to the code breakers at Bletchley Park, essentially reading the Germans' mail. We knew what Hitler was thinking on an hour-by-hour basis." At this point, the idea originally known as Trojan Horse was officially being looked into. To begin the execution of their plan, intelligence officers Ewan Montague and Charles Chumley began looking for a body. Not just any body, though. This one had to be a recently deceased individual who passed the smell test, so to speak. Montague and Chumley realized that German officials would be looking for any sign of potential deception, so they needed to find a body that matched a select number of criteria. In other words, it had to be fresh. And they needed to make sure that this body looked as legitimate as possible. Montague approached a former acquaintance of his, named Bentley Purchase, who worked as a coroner in the St. Pancras district of London. Purchase told him that there was all kinds of red tape surrounding bodies, and that 9 times out of 10, relatives or loved ones of the victims would come calling to collect the body. If he were to tell them that they were out of luck, he would soon be out of a job. In his words, quote, "I should think bodies are the only commodities not in short supply at the moment, but even with bodies all over the place, each one has to be accounted for." Like I said, 9 times out of 10, loved ones came forward to bury or cremate the remains of the recently deceased. However, in that one exception, there was a little bit of leeway for an operation like this to proceed. On January 22nd, 1943, a homeless, alcoholic, mentally troubled individual named Glinder Michael was brought into a London area hospital. He had recently eaten some rat poison, in an incident that was hard to pin down as either a suicide attempt or all-out starvation, and he would spend the next 2 days clinging to life. 2 days later, Michael passed away, and his body ended up in the care of Bentley Purchase, a coroner. Purchase identified this corpse as being suitable for the project on hand, the project given to him by Ewan Montague. The coroner noted that Glinder Michael could appear to look like a victim of either hypothermia or drowning, and stated that the amount of phosphorus in his system would not be easily identified. Unlike arsenic poisoning, phosphorus poisoning would not be as apparent if anyone examined the hair follicles of the body. Also, phosphorus was found naturally within the body, so only the most detailed of autopsies would catch it. Most importantly, though, this tramp, named Glinder Michael, had no direct next of kin. As far as Purchase was concerned, there was nobody looking for him, nobody asking questions about where his body had gone, nothing at all. Ewan Montague initially thought that the corpse of the man in front of them looked too malnourished to be a field officer. However, Bentley Purchase quickly dispelled that thought by stating, quote, "He does not have to look like an officer, only a staff officer." I.e., he could be made to look like someone used to desk work instead of field work. A deal was struck, and Purchase agreed to freeze the body at a temperature of 4 degrees Celsius. Any colder, and the flesh would begin to freeze. However, in doing so, he told Montague that the body needed to be used within the next 3 months, or else they risked the body decomposing too severely and spoiling their plans with it. As the body was put on ice, any hopes of identifying the young man in the near future were discarded. Because the corpse was now part of an intelligence operation, Ewan Montague refused to share the name of the deceased with his colleagues, sharing only that he was, quote, "a bit of a ne'er-do-well, and that the only worthwhile thing that he ever did, he did after his death." On February 4th, 1943, a reworking of Trojan Horse was filed, under the operational name of Mincemeat. It took the bare bones of Charles Chumley's original plan, and refitted it to match the current objective, to deceive the Nazis, and make them believe that an invasion of the Balkans was imminent. Before the Axis powers could be fooled, though, the intelligence operatives working on Operation Mincemeat had to create a brand new identity for the corpse they now had on ice. Ewan Montague and Charles Chumley, who had previously worked together to create a network of fictitious double agents, would take point on the operation. Over the next 2 months, the two men oversaw the creation of a carefully fabricated hoax. The name chosen for the fictitious figure was William Martin, a captain and acting major in the Royal Marines who had been seconded to Naval Intelligence. They chose his rank because it made it believable for him to be carrying top secret documents, yet just lowly enough to not be a memorable figure. If a spy was unfamiliar with him or his name, it would make sense. He was just a desk jockey that was moving documents from point A to point B. And with him being a member of the Royal Marines, any official inquiries into his death would end up being forwarded to Naval Intelligence, the same people orchestrating this fake identity. Every detail of this corpse's new identity was gone over with a fine-tooth comb, from the documents he carried in his briefcase to the quote-unquote pocket litter he had on his person at the time of his supposed death. A similar-looking man with a gaunt face and a large hook-shaped nose was found in the offices of MI5, and he agreed to pose for a couple of photos for William Martin's identification cards. Montague and Chumley even created a fictitious love interest for the young man, a woman named Pam. An MI5 clerk named Jean Leslie volunteered a photograph of herself in a bathing suit to include in his pockets, and she became the face of this fictitious Pam. To fully bring their relationship to life, a letter written by Pam was also included in Captain Martin's pockets, as well as a receipt from a London-based jeweler for a diamond engagement ring. Another letter placed in the pockets was from Captain Martin's fictitious father, a letter described as being, quote, as pompous and pedantic as only an Edwardian father could be. Montague and Chumley tested different kinds of ink to see which would fare the best during long periods of saltwater immersion. They weren't sure when exactly the body of their fictitious marine would be found, so they wanted to make sure that the letters weren't just soggy pieces of paper by the time they got picked up. When they found an ink they liked, they had the letters penned with it to ensure longevity. The planners also tried to make the uniform and possessions of Captain Martin look as realistic as possible. They did not want the clothing to look too fresh or rigid, so they found people of similar builds to wear the items of clothing in the week beforehand, including the underwear. They also made sure to fill up Captain Martin's pockets with some more litter, things like receipts from a show he had seen while in London, bus tickets that tracked his recent trip, etc. Next came the main crux of the mission, the focal point of Operation Mincemeat, the intelligence that the Allies wanted the Axis to see. Montague and Chumley enlisted Lieutenant General Sir Archibald Nye to write some fake correspondence to General Sir Harold Alexander. They had originally tried their hand at it, but it came across as too lifeless and fake-sounding, so they decided to have the Lieutenant General write it himself, as they wanted it to sound as natural as possible. In his letter to General Alexander, Lieutenant General Nye included several menial details, such as discussing recent recipients of minor awards, to help bring life to the lie. Finally, the mission planners approached the office of Vice Admiral Sir John Edgell, the hydrographer of the Navy. They wanted to obtain the assistance of his top analyst to ensure that wherever they left the body, it would end up in the right hands. They wanted it to be a place that the Nazis had a presence in, but would not seem too obvious. After a little bit of thinking, it was decided that the body of Captain William Martin, this fictitious marine concocted out of thin air, would be left floating in the waters of southwestern Spain, near the town of Huelva. On April 13th, 1943, the Committee of Chiefs of Staff met and decided whether or not to proceed with Operation Mincemeat. In a tense vote, the committee gave the thumbs up, but still needed to get final approval from the man himself, Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Colonel John Bevan met with Churchill 2 days later, on April 15th, and told him that several factors of the operation could go wrong, but the potential rewards vastly outweighed the risks. If all went well, this could turn the tide of the war for good, and lead to Allied forces establishing a foothold in southern Europe within months. And if it went wrong, one of the worst things that could happen would be the body was simply returned to British forces undisturbed. When told about the risks, Winston Churchill famously remarked, quote, "In that case, we shall have to get the body back and give it another swim." That day, the plans were signed off by the Prime Minister and then forwarded to the office of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, at the time, was the commander of all Allied military operations in the Mediterranean. On April 17th, 1943, an encrypted telegram was received at General Eisenhower's temporary headquarters. Operation Mincemeat was a go. On April 19th, 1943, the submarine HMS Seraph left its port in Greenock, Scotland. The commander of the sub, Lieutenant Bill Jewell, had previously worked on special operations for Naval Intelligence. He did not tell his crew what was inside the airtight canister that had been delivered to the sub the day prior, quite literally by a race car driver named St. John Horsfall. Lieutenant Jewell had simply told them that it was a meteorological device. The officers on board the sub knew what was in the container, though. A body, packed in tight and surrounded by dry ice. They needed to keep the body partially frozen and deprived of oxygen to avoid the decomposition process, as they needed it to appear fresh. Over the next 10 days, the HMS Seraph would survive two bombing attempts by Axis forces, before arriving near the southwestern coast of Spain. They arrived on April 29th, 1943, and spent most of that first day ensuring that they were in the clear. The last thing they needed was to be bombed or attacked during a highly secretive intelligence operation. In the early morning hours of the next day, April 30th, 1943, the HMS Seraph surfaced. It was around 4:15 when they did so, before sunrise, and Lieutenant Jewell sent his crew below into the sub for the most crucial part of their mission. Joined only by his most trusted officers, Lieutenant Jewell lowered the airtight container into the water. As he and his officers proceeded, Lieutenant Jewell read Psalm 39 from the King James Bible. "Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. O spare me, that I may recover strength, before I go hence and be no more." The body of Captain William Martin, formerly Glinder Michael, was pushed towards the shores of Spain. Chained to his wrist was a briefcase, which had been carefully curated with documents and letters full of false information. The HMS Seraph left that morning, traveling 12 miles before releasing and destroying the airtight container that the body had been held in for 2 weeks. Then, a message was sent to the Royal Navy Admiralty by Lieutenant Jewell, quote, "Mincemeat completed." Just hours after the body was released into the water, on April 30th, 1943, it was recovered. At around 9:30 that morning, a local sardine fisherman named Jose Antonio Rey Maria found the body of Captain William Martin, an acting major in the Royal Marines. The body was handed over to Spanish authorities, who brought it in for an examination. At this point, British Vice Consul Francis Haselden was contacted and told that the body of a Royal Marine had been found in the water. Supposedly, he was the victim of a plane crash somewhere in the Atlantic. Unbeknownst to the Spanish authorities, Vice Consul Haselden was in on the plot, and had been from the beginning. He began sending a series of pre-scripted messages to other British officials, aware that their communications were being intercepted and decrypted. In this round of correspondence, they tried to emphasize the importance of the documents that Captain Martin had been carrying, and Selden was urged to retrieve them as quickly as possible. Vice Consul Francis Selden played a key role over the next couple of days, as he deftly played his part. He insisted that the remains of the deceased be buried as soon as possible, and he should have his belongings returned to his loved ones. The following day, May 1st, 1943, saw an autopsy of the body performed in Huelva, Spain. Haselden was present for the autopsy, and tried to get the medical experts conducting the autopsy to hurry through it, making jokes about the rotten smell of the decomposing body ruining their lunch plans. He also tried to play up the Catholic sensibilities of the Spanish men, noting the crucifix hanging around Martin's neck, a carefully placed item meant for this very purpose. The autopsy, which did not check the body for any sign of poisoning, signed the cause of death as asphyxiation through immersion in the sea. The following day, Major William Martin was buried with full military honors in a local cemetery, just outside of Huelva, near the coastline. His tombstone read that he was the son of John Glinder Martin and the late Antonia Martin of Cardiff, Wales. It also listed his birthday as March 29th, 1907, and marked his death as happening on April 24th, 1943. Over a month later, on June 4th, Major William Martin's name appeared in the newspaper The Times, listed in the daily obituary of fallen soldiers. This had been orchestrated by intelligence operative Ewan Montagu, who wanted to keep the hoax alive. Now, with Martin 6 feet under, members of Britain's naval intelligence just had to hope that their carefully planned operation had been successful. The intelligence now obtained by Spanish officials, which they knew to be incredibly valuable, became the object being used in a delicate game of tug-of-war. In public, British officials had requested Martin's belongings returned to his family. They tried to downplay the importance of the documents, but that was all part of an act. You see, the Abwehr, the German intelligence service the Allies were hoping to fool, had become incredibly interested in viewing the intelligence for themselves. They were making requests with the Spanish government to obtain this knowledge as soon as possible. Using cutting-edge technology, Spanish officials tried to photograph and document every shred of data that they could find, including the letter written by Lieutenant General Nye, which seemed to hint that an invasion of Greece was imminent. In fact, so unique was the Spaniards' method of subterfuge that they extracted the letter, sealed inside an envelope, without opening the seal of the envelope itself. They were able to carefully pry it out between the lip of the envelope and the body, unaware that the Allies had carefully placed an eyelash within the letter to determine whether it had been read or not. These Spanish officials had also opened up the briefcase attached to the body, and had gone through the documents within to piece together who this young Marine was, and what he was carrying. The information deemed important enough to forward was passed on to the Germans on May 8, 1943. It was then given to Abwehr officials, who rushed it straight to Berlin. The briefcase belonging to this Captain William Martin was returned to Vice Consul Francis de Selden just a few days later, on May 11th, 1943. Then, it was mailed back to London in a diplomatic bag, where analysts began looking through it in an effort to see what had been gone through by the Spaniards. Each document was forensically examined, and naval intelligence was able to determine, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the information had been read by the Spanish government. Like I said, they had carefully placed an eyelash inside the most important letter, which was now gone. Even though the seal on the envelope was not broken, it became apparent that the document had been read. Besides the eyelash ruse, sources were able to discover messages being sent between German intelligence agencies and military officials. Messages they decrypted, which stated that an invasion of the Balkans was imminent. General Alfred Jodi, the head of the German Supreme Command Operations Staff, sent a message to one of his staffers which stated about the upcoming Allied invasion. Quote, "You can forget about Sicily. We know it's in Greece." At this point, it seemed like Operation Mincemeat had become a total success. Brigadier Leslie Hollis, who served as the secretary to the Chief of Staff's committee, sent a message to Prime Minister Winston Churchill, which read, quote, "Mincemeat swallowed rod, line, and sinker by the right people, and from the best information, they look like acting on it." Despite the doubts of those who had planned Operation Mincemeat, it became one of the most successful intelligence operations of all time. Adolf Hitler, the German leader, bought into the hoax entirely. On May 12th, just days after German officials received the intel from the Spanish government, he ordered forces over to the Balkans, away from his active military fronts, because he was already paranoid about an invasion of the region, paranoia that grew with every passing day. The intel seemed well-placed to validate his fears. Hitler, demanding that the Balkans be defended at all cost, began moving German forces over to Greece, Sardinia, and Corsica in the middle of May. Over the next several weeks, he more than doubled the German presence in the region, taking away tens of thousands of troops from other regions, including the Eastern Front, France, and Sicily. It is estimated that upwards of 100,000 men were moved away from active war zones to fend off this theoretical invasion. Then, on July 9th, 1943, just 2 months after the success of Operation Mincemeat, the Allies began their invasion of Sicily. Operation Husky, as it was known, oversaw a complete storming of the island by over 160,000 Allied troops.
They called it the mightiest armada in history, spread across the Mediterranean for the Allied invasion of Sicily, July 9, 1943. It was the period of World War II when taking of the large island which lies athwart the narrow waters separating North Africa and the toe of Italy would not only affirm Allied control of the Mediterranean, but would knock Italy right out of the war. The plan called for the U.S. 7th Army to move onto the Sicilian beaches on the south coast and the British 8th Army on the east. The sound of planes was constantly overhead, and gunners kept a sharp lookout. What they heard was our own Air Force ferrying glider infantry and paratroops to the first airborne assault. Then came the naval barrage. These were the opening guns in the Battle of Europe.
Even as Allied troops took Sicily and began moving their way up towards Italy, Adolf Hitler continued to fear that an invasion of the Balkans was imminent. For weeks, if not months, he continued to think that the invasion of Sicily was part of an intricate plot to lure him away from the Balkans. When reality finally grabbed a hold of him again, it refused to let go. On July 13th, just days after the invasion of Sicily began, Hitler began to prematurely wrap up the Kursk Offensive, a major part of his ongoing war with the Soviet Union. When this decision was made, to begin pulling out of the war against the Russians to defend southern Europe, the war began to turn for good. The Nazi regime never regained that foothold in Russia, and Russians continued moving forward, all the way to Berlin many months later. The invasion of Sicily went much easier than anyone had been expecting. The British, in particular, had been expected to lose 10,000 troops in the first week, and planned to lose upwards of 300 ships overall. However, through the entire campaign, they lost only 1,500 men, give or take, and counted only 12 ships lost. What was supposed to be a 90-day campaign wrapped up in only 38. After gaining control of Sicily in August of 1943, the combined might of the Allied forces began moving up to Italy, where the Italian Prime Minister, Benito Mussolini, had already been deposed. To this day, Operation Mincemeat is widely regarded as one of the most important deceptions made in World War II, perhaps in military history. It is likely that Operation Mincemeat changed the entire course of the war, or at the very least, escalated it. Following the invasion of Sicily and then Italy, the war continued on for the better part of the next 2 years. The Allied troops that stormed Sicily moved up to Italy, where they helped neutralize one of the main Axis powers, and then continued battling north until 1944, when several of the same men that had stormed Sicily deployed to France, where they participated in D-Day. The rest is history from there.
Yesterday morning, at 2:41 a.m., at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. But in the interest of saving lives, the ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded along all the fronts. The German war is therefore at an end.
Operation Mincemeat played not only an important role in the ending of World War II, but the future of the United Kingdom as a whole. Ian Fleming, the man many credit with proposing the idea that eventually became Mincemeat, ended up gaining international acclaim for creating the James Bond book series. a series that many think was more autobiographical than fiction. Ewan Montague, the man who helped bring mincemeat to fruition, was appointed as an officer of the Order of the British Empire in 1944. He, along with Charles Cholmondeley, was regarded as one of Winston Churchill's quote-unquote corkscrew thinkers. Charles Cholmondeley, by the way, was also granted the same privilege as his colleague. In 1948, he also was appointed as an officer of the Order of the British Empire, and credited as the man behind Operation Trojan Horse, the direct predecessor to Mincemeat. Military historian Michael Howard described Operation Mincemeat as, quote, perhaps the most successful single deception operation of the entire war. He also credits Hitler's congenital obsession with the Balkans for amplifying its effect, and making it as easy as possible for the Allies to invade Sicily with very little resistance. Amias Godfrey, a member of the defense think tank RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, said about the operation, quote, this was a period when there was a lot of spying and double bluffing going on, but Mincemeat was exceptional as the biggest roll of the dice. It was an extraordinary operation in extraordinary times. Do it once and do it well was, and is, very much the ethos. Ben McIntyre, another historian, stated about Mincemeat, quote, it was probably the most elaborate, certainly one of the oddest, and certainly one of the most successful deception operations ever undertaken. In 1953, Ewan Montague published a book about the operation, titled The Man Who Never Was. Written in a single weekend, the book was derived from Montague's own notes taken from the process of orchestrating this hoax, and included his own recollection of events, which became the official version of the story for about half a century. The book was a smashing success, ultimately selling upwards of 2 million copies, leading to a film adaptation in 1956. In fact, the audio you heard at the very beginning of this episode was the trailer for said film, which went by the same name as the book, The Man Who Never Was. When writing the book, Ewan Montague had to leave several aspects of the story on the cutting room floor. Among them were not only aspects about Operation Barclay, the more comprehensive deception campaign waged by British intelligence before the invasion of Sicily, but also details about the man whose body had been used by the operation. The deceased young man, whose remains were taken by British officials and transformed into the fictional William Martin, remained buried in a cemetery outside of Huelva, Spain. He remained nameless, his identity a forgotten relic of a time gone by. In 1977, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission took responsibility for the grave of Major William Martin. However, at that point, he was still just William Martin, a Royal Marine, a fallen hero of the British Empire. It wasn't until 1996 that the real man, Glinder Michael, got his name back. It was in this year that Roger Morgan, a historian from London, was able to track down his identity after many months and weeks of research in the Public Records Office. He was able to state, definitively, that the man who was buried in southwestern Spain was not just some nameless tramp, but a tragic figure, who had ended up a hero in death. In 1997, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission added a postscript to the tombstone of the deceased, which read, Glinder Michael, served as Major William Martin, RN. Glinder Michael led a very misguided life, eventually falling prey to either desperation or starvation. But his story will always be remembered, and he will forever be the man that never was.
I'm Peter John in English Media. Title music is by Croatian artist Blasco and is published under Creative Commons. You can find this podcast on dmpodcast.net, DM is for Daily Minutes, and on several other platforms. De internetfaciliteiten en studio hardware voor Daily Minutes worden gesponsord door 70MHzShop.nl. 70MHzShop.nl.
Daily Minutes Podcast. Whoever hears this is crazy.
En microfoon naar retour.
Und an alle Mädchen, 88.